automatically.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Mary Deserby. My attorney registration number is 38541. And together with my father, Victor Zerby, I represent the defendant appellant, Joseph Pacheco. And because of the time limits today, we intend to focus our argument on the clearest basis for reversal of this conviction, the suppression of the videotape questioning of the defendant. We submit the trial court erred when it failed to suppress the videotape. There was no probable cause to arrest, no attenuation of the illegal arrest, and it was compounded by the illegal entry and insufficient Miranda.
Ms. Zerby, can I ask you just to move that microphone closer to you? That's where we record. Thank you.
The arresting officers in this case did not have objective facts or circumstances, one, justifying the belief that any offense had been committed, or two, justifying the belief the defendant had committed an offense. The court in People v. Gulick states, the touchstone supporting police action is specificity, and that is what is missing in this case. Mere suspicion does not constitute probable cause.
Well, let me ask you, Ms. Zerby, on the facts as I understand them. We have the police show up, they get the 911 call, I understand your argument, just said there's a man down, they don't tell them why or what. But they get there, they find a guy laying on the ground, there's at least some disheveled rugs, there's blood on him, but he's not bleeding. Somebody in the room says there was an altercation with the defendant. Why isn't that enough? I mean, we have to look from an objective, reasonable police officer. Why? Oh, and then also the defendant is gone, and then we learn relatively soon, and then he comes back when the cops leave. Why isn't that enough?
To start off with the rugs, what was actually testified to was that there was one rug flipped over, and the people at the scene did not know at that time that the blood did not come from the victim. What was known at the scene and what was known by the EMTs treating him was simply that this person may have had a heart attack. That is how the entire incident at the scene was treated by both the police officer and by the EMTs there. What has come out later is the officer's very wavering statement about what she thought or believed she heard, and she couldn't even identify the speaker as being someone who was there at the time the incident occurred.
Well, with regard to that, and you're talking about a Deputy Cisneros, I believe, right?
Yes, Your
Honor. My understanding is, first of all, that the trial court made a specific finding of credibility that what she said was credible, and second of all, that she had said something very similar at the same time with the CBI when she gave them a statement. So she was consistent in what she said and the court found it to be credible.
And this is one of those particular cases where deference is normally given to the trial court's establishment for finding the facts. But those facts have to be supported by the record. And in this case, the interview with the CBI was not done until the next morning, which was 9 hours after the defendant was arrested. What was known from the phone call and from directly the officer on that night was that she didn't know who said that and that her other facts were wrong. She asserted that the victim had had a heart attack the week before, and when that came out, the evidence came out, there was absolutely no evidence that the defendant or that the victim had suffered a heart attack. This is one of those very unusual cases where we are asserting that the facts that the court found are not supported by what is actually in the record. And I apologize, was there a part of that question that I did not address?
No.
Again, it was what the officer testified was what she believed or thought she was told. She was told she thought the argument had gotten physical. But again, if there had been evidence of a major struggle, we would have expected something other than one rug flipped over or tiny spots of blood that may have been associated with the fall or with CPR.
Can I go back to the actual dispatch phone call, please?
Yes.
You said that, or perhaps it was Judge Gabriel that inquired about it, that there was a man down. The dispatch was told there's a man down. Wasn't it more specific than that? Wasn't there a statement made that the victim was badly hurt?
Badly injured, but that gives no inference that it was anything more than an accident or someone having been injured from the heart attack. Injured does not necessarily lead to a suspicion of wrongdoing.
By itself, I agree, but in combination with other things, when the indication is there's been some kind of physical altercation.
But again, what was known at the scene was not that there was a physical altercation, other than the one statement by the officer who couldn't identify the speaker as someone who would have had personal knowledge.
But didn't the, and correct me if this is wrong, please, didn't the officer understand it was somebody in the house and the people were known to the officers, a small community? I thought that was in the record. I mean, what you say in brief, Deputy Cisnero testified, someone either, I think his victim's wife or one of the first responders said the victim was arguing with his dad, or the defendant was arguing with his dad, and I believe it got physical. So someone in the house or one of the first responders reports to the police officer, someone here told me, I believe it got physical, and it was an altercation with the defendant.
And
aren't you asking, my concern here, very frankly, is that you're asking us to second-guess the police officer on the scene, and I'm not sure we're allowed to do that, particularly in light of the fact that we have a finding by the trial judge who assesses the credibility.
And I do understand that. I would go back to the absolute uncertainty of what the officer said. If it had come from one of the emergency responders, that person was not on scene at the time of the physical altercation. Having that distinction between the only person who was on scene during the alleged altercation, which was the victim's wife and the defendant's mother, versus relatives who came over later who had no personal knowledge, and the EMTs who had no personal knowledge, who simply may have brought in biases from their small town experience. And that is really the concerning issue in this case, is when the officer is so unclear about where the information came from and who it came from, and the fact that her other facts during that time period are incorrect, that is not the sort of reliable information that these very important probable cause decisions should turn on. Assuming that the police did have a justified concern that an argument had taken place, they had no information about it getting physical or what kind of physical conduct had occurred. The court also brought up the issue of whether or not the defendant's leaving was an inference of guilt. And we would assert that that is the type of, certainly nobody is going to contest that police have to go out and verify every innocent explanation in order to say that would be suspicious. However, what's really critical here is that there was no evidence given at the trial court that about when the defendant left, whether he left after the victim was down, or when the phone call was made, or any of that sort of information. That was not found at the trial court in the probable cause finding. Specifically, and I apologize. So there were no facts about when the defendant left the house in relation to when the deceased collapsed, or anything specific that he may have done with his father. We do acknowledge that police probably had a good reason for wanting to talk to him. But the very specificity that this sort of probable cause determination turns on was not there with this particular officer, especially in light of her inability to identify where her information came from, and the fact that the other information she asserted at the scene turned out to be incorrect.
Could you maybe give us an example? What would have been specific enough? I'm trying to figure out where the line is on your argument.
And I think that line is going to move from case to case. In
sure.
This particular case, having direct understanding of who that piece of information came from so they could judge the credibility of the statement would have been the specificity. Because all they knew was that there was a man down, and the EMTs. So even with the officer on the scene directing the EMTs, EMTs never treated this as an assault victim. They treated it as a heart attack. And I think that's the clearest piece of evidence that shows that the officer herself was not clear.
How would the treatment be different? I'm puzzled by that. As I understand it, the victim was unconscious. He wasn't breathing. He's lying there. He can't talk, can't speak, can't relate anything. Why is the treatment for a heart attack different than the treatment for an assault?
Generally, it will be in what the officers, I would assert, are doing at the scene and directing for notifying an EMT. We think there was a fall. Do we need to check for a head wound? Is there things that we need to be careful of? Do we need to keep track of whose blood this is? So it's in combination with the treatment by the EMTs and what the officers did not suggest the EMTs needed to be considered in treatment of the individual.
Why would the officer ever suggest to the medic what needed to be done? Isn't it the other way around?
In many cases, it would be. In this particular context, the EMTs and the officers work extremely closely, especially when officers are on the scene. I'm not sure if the court noticed that there was a significant amount of interaction between the EMTs and the officers. And at this point, I would ask the court respectfully if I may reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Katherine Hansen, registration number 25464, appearing on behalf of the people in this matter. I think it's important when we're talking about probable cause to remember three very important principles when determining whether a reasonable officer under the facts and circumstances would have reason to believe that a crime was committed by the defendant. First of all, it's not required that the officer know exactly what particular crime has been committed. It's also not required that the officer have proof beyond a reasonable doubt that a crime has been committed. And in a similar vein, it's not required that the officer dispel any hypothesis of innocence, resolve any possible defense the defendant may have had. So in light of those principles, I think it's important to look at what the officers knew at the time of the arrest in this case, which we agree happened at the point at which he was taken into custody of his home. First of all, I would like to kind of talk overarching about the testimony of Officer Cisneros, because much has been made of the fact, or argued, that she was uncertain in her recollection and that she was not a reliable witness, it was not reliable information, arguments such as this. I think if you look at her testimony throughout the suppression hearing, she repeatedly uses the word believe. Even defense counsel and the prosecutor at times use the words belief. And so I think it's important to look at that phrasing in that context. When she talked about the statements that she received from the victim's wife about the heart attack and the history of heart problems, she specifically said, "I believe I spoke to Trini, the wife, and asked the medical questions. And I believe she told me he had a heart attack and had a week prior." Again, she's not expressing any uncertainty as to really whether this was told, and I think you look at her testimony overall, she didn't have any concern that that was told to her. I think the use of the word believe was just simply the way she speaks, her phrasing. Later, she also talks about, or actually soon thereafter, she spoke, talks about speaking with the victim's wife and speaking with the people in the home. And she said, "I believe it was Trini or the elderly couple that was there that said that Joe Pacheco and his father had had an argument and it became physical." Again, I don't think this is an expression of doubt that that was said. It possibly is an expression of uncertainty as to which of the individuals that were there said it. But I think that the trial court did a very good job in its order in assessing that and addressing that issue of the uncertainty of who said that. I don't think there was any question it was said. There may have been a question who said it, but under the circumstances, with all of the people in the home being known to the officer and all of the people being there and present, I think the officer or the court also talked about the fact that Ms. Pacheco was present, and so had someone else said it and had it not been accurate, you would expect that she would have corrected that, said no, that didn't happen. And so the court used that, those kind of factors in determining that this was said by someone who either had knowledge or was told by someone with knowledge about what had happened.
Would it be enough, Ms. Hansen, if it was one of the EMTs told the detective, this is just hypothetical, that said, you know, one of these folks told me there was an altercation. Is that enough, or is that, you know, I suppose Ms. Zerbe was suggesting here, kind of hearsay components and anonymous tipsters kind of issues here. Is it enough if the EMT just says, you know, somebody told me there was an altercation? Or
yes.
You have to?
Okay. Absolutely. Because under the circumstances, the trial court also recognized, we don't have anonymous tipsters. We have people who are present, who are engaged in caring for this individual and trying to help this individual. And it's reasonable to assume they would have obtained that information in an effort to help them. We don't have anyone with any sort of motivation. It's essentially a citizen informant, which we consider to be reliable information in the absence of evidence otherwise. There's, I think from the 911 call, again, I think it's very important actually that there was a reference to the victim being badly injured. There was not, I think that's quite a bit different than saying, my husband is having a heart attack, my husband can't breathe, my husband has stopped breathing. Injured implies causation, implies something happened. It certainly doesn't rule out the possibility that he was injured and the defendant was acting in self-defense or such, but certainly it implies and it supports the notion that there was a physical altercation. What also supports the notion that there was a physical altercation was the physical evidence at the scene, one of which was the few throw rugs, and Officer Cisneros referred to them as few throw rugs. They were not only kicked over or moved in such a way that would be consistent with a physical struggle, they were very near where the victim's body was lying, and there was blood on them as well as there was on the victim. And even though it was unclear where that blood came from, the fact that there was blood on him and on the carpet or the rugs suggests, again, a physical altercation.
Let me ask you also, Ms. Hansen, I mean, the officers, or at least Detective Cisneros, and I think there was another officer, both said, I don't think I have probable cause. How much weight is a trial judge supposed to give to something like that? I know we're not bound by that. The court makes an own determination of the law. But it is a little troubling when, you know, the police officer on the scene herself says, I didn't think I had probable cause.
Well, I think what she said was, I didn't believe a crime had been committed. That may be splitting hairs. I don't think Officer Soto said that. I think he said his intention was to take him in for questioning. I don't think he opined one way or the other whether there was probable cause. You know, Officer Cisneros, from what I can tell, had 2 years on the job. You know, it's a small community, and frankly, she may not have felt there was probable cause. Certainly her decision to take the defendant into custody was approved by her supervisor. But again, I think certainly it doesn't vitiate the probable cause. We look at that objectively to the extent that Rodriguez tells us that we can consider it as to credibility or what the facts were in present. I don't think it vitiates anything with regard to that. So certainly Rodriguez tells us it's not completely irrelevant, but I don't think it's relevant here. And it certainly can't alone vitiate probable cause. Finally, I'd like to talk a little bit about, I think, the fact that the defendant was known to have a history of problems with alcohol and problems with the law, and was familiar with the law. I think that goes into the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from the fact that he was present clearly at the time, from what the officers knew, during the altercation, certainly not present at the time they arrived, which was shortly thereafter, and then came back to the house right after, and then was seen through the window, kind of in a morose type position. Certainly different inferences can be drawn from that. We don't know when he heard that his father had died, so he had a phone, so I acknowledge that could have been. But taking all the information, I think a reasonable inference from this evidence is that he did leave the house because he was aware that he had engaged in conduct that was likely criminal, that was, it caused his father's injury. Whether he knew at the time that he had died, he certainly knew that he had engaged in a physical confrontation with him. And also the fact that he engaged in a confrontation with a man who was elderly, had had a history of heart problems, and according to the officer's information, which apparently was provided by the victim's wife, that he'd had a recent heart attack, whether it was 1 week prior or 6 weeks prior, as borne out by the trial testimony. I don't think that's a critical distinction. You had a defendant engaging in a physical altercation with an elderly man who he knew had a heart condition, and as I described in my brief, there's multiple crimes for which that would establish probable cause.
Ms. Hanson, I want to switch gears and go to the Miranda advisement. Here we have a police officer, well, CBI agent specifically, who kind of puts the cart before the horse, if you will, and holds up the Miranda form and says, are you going to be willing to talk to me once we sign the Miranda form? And he's inebriated under any scenario. How inebriated is debatable, but he's drunk at the time. Why isn't that coercive in this context? I mean, he hasn't gone through it. He hasn't checked every box. Yes, yes, no, I don't need an attorney, so forth, so on. Why isn't it coercive for a CBI agent in that scenario to be potentially taking advantage of a drunk defendant?
Well, okay, first of all, I don't think there was evidence that at the time that he was doing this, that he was intoxicated such that he couldn't validly waive his Miranda rights, and the court made that finding. It's not been disputed. The defendant appeared coherent. But I think what's important, actually, is to look at exactly how this exchange started. It did not start with the officers, this agent, simply coming in and saying, hey, are you going to agree to talk to me? Because if you are, then we'll go through this. It started with her telling him, I'd like to advise you. Those are her first words. I'd like to advise you because you're in custody and you can't leave. So I'm going to go through this form. And it's an advisement of right form. And she starts off by telling him, I'm going to advise you of your rights. And he interrupts her and says, why am I under investigation? So he's initiating a discussion separate from the form.
Except that the court didn't find that. The trial court here specifically found what she did was improper, or he, I can't remember the age, it was a male or female, was improper. So we're bound by that. No one's appealed that issue. So we have that preliminary questioning was improper. The judge found that.
I disagree. I don't think you're bound by that. The court found that was improper interrogation. The question of whether that's interrogation is a legal conclusion that this court can consider. And certainly the question of whether the advisement was somehow tainted or the waiver was tainted by these preparatory comments, I think that's a legal conclusion. The court didn't make any specific findings that this didn't happen.
Well, why wouldn't it be improper? And you have, let's take, I'll make it a clear hypothetical. The officer says, I'm going to read you his rights. You'll talk to me after I give them to you, right? Well, sure. Now I read you my rights. The person's already committed to speak, and they're unlikely to change their position now when they get the rights. Why is that? How could that be proper?
Well, I actually don't think it's improper. I respectfully disagree. Okay. I think it's completely, you're not committing to make a decision. You're saying, sure, I'll talk. And I think in this case, it was clear he wanted to talk to them. He kept interrupting, saying, fine, I'll talk. But even if we have your hypothetical, you have a defendant who is asked one, maybe two questions. Hey, I'm going to go through this, but do you want to talk to me? If he says yes, and then they read the advisement, they again ask him. They don't just read the advisement and then start. They again ask, okay, having been advised of these rights, do you want to talk to me? I mean, that clearly tells the defendant, you have a choice. He's just been told you have a choice in the Miranda advisement.
But how does that look if you're the defendant? Yeah, I'll talk to you. Now let me read you my rights. Oh, you know what? No, I won't talk to you. Could you not see a concern of a defendant, feeling now I'm in an awkward position. I said first I'll talk. Now I heard my rights. Now I'm not going to talk. I mean, I could pursue. Isn't that the whole purpose of the rights, is to make a knowing waiver before you say I'll talk?
Correct. And ultimately, his decision to talk was made after a knowing waiver.
But the point is, how do we, if he said, first, I'll talk before he had a waiver,
so
your view is that there's no way that that taint, that, that, that this procedure would taint the waiver?
Not under these circumstances or in the hypothetical you described. There's no coercion in either circumstance. It's simply discussion. It's prefatory comments. If you look at the cases that I said in my brief, Madrid and some of those cases, there were way more elaborate discussions prior to the Miranda advisement and waiver. I want to get your side of the story. We want to hear what you have to say, that kind of thing. And those were found not to constitute any sort of coercion or taint. So some people might feel awkward, some people might not feel awkward. Certainly a defendant such as this one who has an extensive history with law enforcement contact would not likely feel like, well, you said you were going to advise me, I interrupted you, you explained, wait a minute, I'm going to go through this with you if you want to talk to me. Do you want to talk to me? I seriously don't think this defendant in this situation was coerced by simply being asked before the actual advisement whether he wanted to talk. And I certainly think in this circumstances, the officer's comments were precipitated by the defendant asking the questions because she started off wanting to advise him. But any absence, even in your hypothetical, in the absence of any evidence of coercion or anything that would reasonably taint, I think that just wouldn't taint a waiver, especially since you have another request for a waiver after the advisement is read.
Thank you.
So, did I answer your question?
Yeah, because
yeah, because okay. It was pretty much the same as Judge Gabriel.
Okay, and I understand this is, you know, there may be situations where it's extreme pressure to get someone to talk, and then they agree, and then you do the advisement, but we just simply don't have that here. Thank you. We would ask that this court affirm.
Thank you.
I'm just double checking my time, 3:46 it is. Good morning, gentlemen.
Mr. Sir, would you just introduce yourself for the record?
Victor Zerbe, 4774, one of the attorneys for the defendant appellate. Gentlemen, from my point of view, the critical issue is the officers at the scene had no idea what had occurred between the father and the son whatsoever. They were told, and perhaps we can accept that a physical confrontation may have occurred, but what did the defendant do that constituted a crime? And there's not one iota of evidence about that. Did somebody push somebody? Did somebody hit somebody? I recognize you don't have to eliminate all the possible self-defenses and other defenses, but you have to have some objective facts upon which to base probable cause. In the simple occurrence, there was a fight, and there's a bunch of people there. Do we arrest them all? Is that what probable cause is about? No. There has to be articulable facts related to the person involved, that he committed a crime or that a crime was committed. We submit that is what is totally lacking in the case regarding probable cause. We can argue about what the language means on physical altercation forever. But in this case, there is no specificity. In this case, cried out for trying to determine what the officer thought or believed had happened. This is mere suspicion. This is really Brown versus Illinois. Taking somebody in when you don't know what happened and hoping over time your facts are going to develop. And that's exactly what happened in this case. Exactly what happened. Regarding Miranda, I'm going to step to that immediately because that's going to raise justifiably by the court. In this case, the court specifically did find that the conduct of the officers was improper. That has not been cross-appealed. So that issue and that finding is there. The question is, what happened between it and the time of the advisement? And if we're talking about attenuation, there was no attenuation between the two. None whatsoever. This is a case where lack of attenuation is critical. Because in this case, the number of things that constitute lack of attenuation is almost limitless. Attenuation is not the absence of something happening generally. Attenuation is something that occurs. Certainly there was a passage of time. But what happened? The police illegally entered his home to arrest him. The defendant was repeatedly told that he was only being held for questioning. He was not advised of his rights when placed into custody at the jail. There's nothing in the record indicating that. He was not advised, given an opportunity to speak to his family. He wasn't advised of his rights till the next day, immediately before the events in question.
Mr. Serby, how could they have advised him and gotten any kind of a coherent response given his blood alcohol level at 2 o'clock in the morning?
That's a significant issue, but there was no attempt made at any point in time. He was not given an attempt to see his family. The things that are normally attenuations are taking a defendant in front of a judge. They chose at 8 in the morning not to do that. To, in fact, let him see his family, to let him see an attorney.
Did he ask to see an attorney or see his family?
There's no evidence in the record that request was made, but there's no attempt. There's nothing in the record that indicates that he was given the opportunity to do that. He, in fact, was taken to the hospital once in the middle of the night, and secondly, had his fingernails cleaned. I've only got 10 seconds left beyond that. So at this time, I respectfully request that reversal occur in this case for the reasons stated. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. Case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.